This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Hello, and welcome to Bodies of Horror, the podcast where we look at all of our favorite horror films, from the classic, the camp, to the cringe, through the lens of disability. My name is Nicole, I'm your host, and I am thrilled to have you here. So, what is on the examination table for this episode? 2003's May, directed by Lucky McKee and starring Angela Bettis, Anna Faris, and Jeremy Sisto. This was Lucky McKee's first solo directorial writing effort, having previously released All Cheerleaders Die with co-director and co-writer Chris Siverton in 2001. Bonus fun fact here, if you've seen All Cheerleaders Die, I'm going to assume you saw Lucky and Chris's 2013 remake of the film. This is considered is considered kind of a breakout role for Bettis, even though she had small roles in films like Girl Interrupted and Bless the Child. And certainly, I think this film carved a path for her in horror, I'd say. I think you'll find this film is really well regarded by horror fans, and I think that that credit mostly belongs to Bettis' phenomenal performance. Now, May had a very limited theatrical run upon release, only 9 theaters in North America, and it made $150,000 roughly back of its $1.7 million budget, but it would go on to gross $634,803 worldwide. I typically don't talk a lot about box office, but I thought that these numbers were interesting in terms of its reputation as kind of a new cult classic. With some of those background pieces laid out, let's get to the plot, yes? As always, I welcome friend of the pod, Wikipedia, for their tried and true segment. Veterinary assistant May Kennedy experienced a troubled childhood due to her lazy eye. Her only true friend is a glass-encased doll named Susie, which her mother made and gifted May for her birthday with the adage, "If you can't find a friend, make one." Her optometrist fixes May's lazy eye, first with glasses, then with contact lenses. But one thing that this plot synopsis misses out is that May had actually used a patch on her eye prior to getting glasses and the contact lens. So now we're with adult May, and May befriends local mechanic Adam and eventually begins dating him. She fixates on his hands, which she considers to be the most attractive part of him. May's lesbian colleague Polly also shows an interest in her. One day, May remarks that Polly has a beautiful neck. During their flirtation, Polly gives May a pet cat, Loopy. May invites Adam to her apartment where he shows her a film titled Jack and Jill that he made for university. The film displays two young lovers who go on a picnic and end up eating each other. May becomes aroused by the cannibalism in the film. While passionately kissing, she bites Adam's lip, drawing blood. Disturbed, Adam abruptly leaves. May shouts at Susie and shoves her in the cupboard. May later begins volunteering at a school for blind children, where she takes a liking to a sullen young girl named Petey, who makes her clay ashtray with the name May pressed into it. Abandoned by Adam, May gives in to Polly's advances and starts a short affair. May overhears Adam saying that he is glad he could get rid of her. Devastated, she visits Polly but finds her with another girl named Ambrosia. When Lupe refuses to come near her, an enraged May throws Petey's ashtray at her, killing Cat and shattering the ashtray. She develops delusions that Susie is talking to her. May takes Susie to the school, that she's volunteering at and introduces Susie to the blind children as her best friend. The children struggle to take Susie out of the glass case, ultimately shattering the case and injuring themselves and May. May returns home devastated with the ruined doll. The following day, she meets a young punk who asks her if she wants to get some candy with him, which she accepts. May admires the tattoos on his arm. At her house, he discovers Lupe's corpse and calls May a freak. May breaks down and fatally stabs him in the head. After heavily contemplating her future actions, May claims he needs more parts. On Halloween night, May dresses in a homemade costume resembling Susie. She adopts a normal personality and goes to Polly's house, where she slits Polly's throat with a pair of surgical scalpels. When Ambrosia arrives, May stabs her in the temple. Next, she visits Adam and his new girlfriend, his house. May murders both of them with scalpels. At home, she designs her new friend, a life-size patchwork doll made from Punk's arms, Polly's neck, Ambrosia's legs, Adam's hands, his girlfriend's ears, and Loopy's fur for the hair. Using the broken remnants of the May ashtray to form an anagram, she names the doll Amy. She realizes that Amy has no eyes and cannot see, so she gouges out her lazy eye. Crying in pain and bleeding, she puts the eye on Amy's head and begs the doll to look at her. She collapses on the bed beside the doll and caresses it. Her creation comes to life and brushes her face affectionately with Adam's hands. Alright. So that is May. Now, maybe you've seen May before, and when you saw that this was an episode here, you were curious as to how I would connect this to disability. Maybe you haven't seen May, but having listened to the plot synopsis, are curious how I will connect this to disability. So let's do this. So we're introduced to May as a young girl, and we learn that she has a lazy eye, or amblyopia, I believe is the term. You'll find some hot takes on whether this itself is a disability, but it is a visual impairment with levels of severity. Young May is fitted with a patch, a common form of treatment or management for a lazy eye, and later has glasses and then contacts. Wearing glasses or contacts, even wearing a patch as a kid, wouldn't seemingly impact May's day-to-day life in a highly significant way or ways that we would look at, other disabilities. But I think it's important to look at the ways it does impact her life. She's bullied and name-called by kids at school because she wears a patch. And I think this is an experience that lots of kids with disabilities can relate to. And these experiences can have a real lasting impact. It can make it difficult as you get older even to socialize and try to make friends because there is this lingering kind of self-consciousness and or fear of what will happen, of what people will say or do. It is easy to think that this type of, carelessness or cruelty stops as we get older, but for myself at the age of 42, I still get looks and comments from other adults about my appearance. I like to think I have been equipped with the proper tools to navigate these admittedly rare occurrences, but they still can really, really hurt. Now, we only get brief moments with young May, but her relationship with her mom especially is something worth noting on a couple of fronts. She checks the boxes of being that slightly overbearing parent that I've talked about in other episodes, specifically when we're talking about children that are dealing with significant healthcare challenges. I think she does care a great deal about her daughter. I think we see this with her giving May Susie as a gift. But sometimes this super involved or overbearing approach can lay a foundation for infantilization. I think we see elements of that as we get to know adult May. She lives independently, she has a job, she is surrounded by dolls, including Susie. She has lots of dolls kind of in her room and all around. Like I said, Susie was a very sweet gift from her mom. It was something that her mom made, and it had meaning for her to give it to me. And she gives Susie to May, knowing that May is having a real rough go of forming friendships at that time. And Susie can kind of be that stand-in. But she is not allowed to take her out of her display box. Susie is not only there to symbolize a friend she can't actually engage with, but an idea of perfection that isn't attainable. Or is it? These things play out so strongly for me as an adult. She figures out that perfection is attainable if you piece together the perfect parts. She is awkward, and I'll get more into that in a moment when talking or connecting with other people. She wears glasses, but is really excited to get contacts before her first date with Adam because she thinks he won't like her or will like her less if she's wearing glasses. This little moment kind of made me sad because it is really relatable. This feeling or drive to hide or cover up aspects of our disability to feel more likable, speaking again to that self-consciousness or fear that can develop as a result of that teasing or bullying that occurs as a kid. I want to talk about May's awkwardness a little bit more explicitly here. In doing research for this episode, I came across two interesting reads, one by Ashley Vivian, talking about the character of May through the lens of the creepy loner girl trope, and one by, and I'm going to butcher this name, Ira Gislason over at Hear a Scream, sharing how they connected with May as someone who received an autism diagnosis in their 20s. I found these pieces fascinating because of the two very different perspectives, but they really hit on many of the same notes, and there's some common threads that we'll explore here. In describing May through the creepy loner girl trope, and kind of describing that, you're thinking of a lonely, misunderstood young woman whose freaky fascinations cause her peers to avoid or even bully her, as viewers cannot help but feel sad for this individual. Vivian clearly points out how May doesn't necessarily fit the descriptor in a clear-cut way. Obviously, creepy and loner, we kind of get that, can understand that with May. We don't see her socializing a lot, but at the same time, she does build relationships with coworkers, particularly Polly, and she does want to pursue a relationship with Adam. And this is where Vivian is really pointing out where the character of May kind of veers from that kind of descriptor. She does pursue those relationships, and both Polly and Adam are drawn May's weirdness in different ways. It's not a setup of, you know, them being immediately repulsed by her. They're truly into her. It's not because they are even feeling kind of guilted, or pity for May. It's really interesting, and I think it's a fascinating way to undercut the kind of pity aspect of the character. May does have autonomy. She does build relationships. She does. She can have this support system. And so I don't know. I thought that was a really interesting thing to point out in this piece. Vivian also goes on to compare May to other characters. Interestingly enough, it goes back to the character of Harry, which covered on an episode, but Angela Bettis played Harry in the 2002 TV movie, I want to say. I'm messing up the year, I'm sure, but Angela Bettis did play Carrie, so it was kind of a neat kind of full circle moment there. But I think when we do talk a lot about tropes, I think it's equally important to not only explore and discuss the ways that, yes, a character can fall into these very kind of hard and fast lines within the trope, but how, in order to kind of make the trope a little bit dynamic, you have to have those kind of outlying bits as well, so that they're not necessarily just a cookie cutter, so to speak. Gislason's piece has a different perspective in looking at May, calling the character extremely autistic coded. May does form relationships with Polly and Adam, but there is an awkwardness to their interactions. May mimics or copies social behaviors as a means to mask or fit in, so she isn't seen as too much or going too far. She bites Adam after he shows her his Cannibals in Love, Jack and Jill student film, because she thinks that this is what he wants, or what he expects, more importantly. He abruptly leaves, and she is left a little confused and heartbroken. Adam, or May, tells Adam on separate occasions, that she's weird or disgusting, but he says he likes that about her. When he tells May that he wants her to, quote unquote, disgust him, she goes into a pretty graphic story about a surgery gone wrong at the vet. And as she's going through this story and kind of recounting it very matter-of-factly, she's not picking up on kind of the increasing levels of uncomfortableness that Adam is displaying the story. I mean, I think it's kind of multi-level. Like, maybe he wasn't anticipating her to pull out this, pretty gruesome tale of, a dog with its innards spilled out. But, they're sitting in a park and they're sharing a sandwich. Not necessarily like a story that you're, I think, prepared to hear while, having lunch. But, again, she's not really picking up on his kind of levels of uncomfortableness, and it's kind of interesting. Gislason also explains that masking is an exhausting process, and I don't doubt that Adam telling me that he likes her weirdness makes her feel perhaps more comfortable in relaxing that mask and being, I guess, a bit more of her authentic self. I really do like Gislason's piece at Hear a Scream because she goes further into talking a bit about some specific connects with the character of May and kind of her experience of having autism. And, she goes on to talk about the dancing that May does when she's happy as being a form of stemming. So, just really interesting kind of bits and pieces there that I really enjoyed because it's really easy to look at these characters as coded. And, for those of us who may not have a certain diagnosis or condition, we can kind of, you know, talk about it in really general ways. But I loved the way that Chislasson really unpacks so much of this to really take what is just kind of a general and really superficial look into something that's a little bit more complex and in depth. So I'll link that in the show notes, as well as the other piece I just talked about, Ashley Vivian's, so that you can read both of those, because I think it is interesting to get those perspectives. It definitely made me think about, you know, some certain moments a little bit differently. So I guess I kind of want to wrap things up with the film discussion and talking briefly about the scenes with students from the School for the Blind. So May sees a group of kids at the park when she is there with Adam. She asks Adam about them. I think she makes a comment about, you know, why are they moving this way? Because these are blind students. None of them, I don't think, are using canes. They're just kind of like, I guess, kind of groping around. I have feelings about it. But she comments, and she's like, who are these kids? And he tells her that these are kids from the nearby school for blind. So she begins to volunteer at the school. And I think this is done out of seeking an understanding and camaraderie with someone or others, because these students are blind. May has a visual impairment. However, this ends badly, with Susie being broken, and I would assume this further underscores those feelings of fear that I mentioned May potentially having when trying to reach out and connect with others. You know, here are people that you think will get you, that it's this, you know, quote-unquote safe space, and suddenly it just, the whole interaction goes bad. I find this interesting, and I think it then speaks to how things play out in the end. But I admit that I found the scenes with the blind students a little difficult in my first couple of watches, as I kind of think back to those. They seemed a little unnecessary, outside of just being, you know, there as plot movement to have Susie be broken and thus pushing May to make a new friend. But I liked that there was kind of, I liked being able to kind of explore possibly a deeper read, like, you know, again, with May wanting to connect to others that may have an understanding of her that others wouldn't, that she can share a piece of her that she hasn't been able to do so far, both in terms of her lazy eye, but also I think, you know, she brings Susie with her to the school. She, you know, she's not taking Susie with her to work to show Polly. I don't think she pulls out Susie when Adam comes over. So, you know, this is something she's sharing pieces of herself, and it just doesn't go well. And I don't know, that is, I think, kind of a sad kind of undertone there. So yeah, I guess, you know, on this rewatch, I really like this film, because I think each time I go back and revisit it, I see and discover kind of new little nuances. And I think a lot of that, again, gets owed to Bettis's just phenomenal performance. It's really, really good. I was just kind of sifting through some reviews, and I was going back to Ebert's review of the film. And I think he makes a really important point of, you know, the ending where, you know, this doll that she's created out of these human parts comes to life and caresses her, comforts her. In really any other film, it would feel really laughable or hokey, just completely nothing. But here, there's a real specialness to it, a real profoundness to it. And I think that Ebert states, you know, this is because of the film and its uniqueness and its approach, it really earns kind of this moment. It doesn't come off as, you know, ridiculous because it just feels very suited. And I like that. I definitely agree because when you are talking about this film and kind of going through a plot synopsis and explaining, like, this is what happens, people will kind of look at you like, really? That happens? I'm like, yeah, it totally does. So, yeah, that's May. I really enjoy this movie. It was fun revisiting it as we seem to be in the midst of a bit of a Frankenstein and Frankenstein inspired movie renaissance. As always, a huge thank you to the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad for being the heart and the home of Bodies of Horror. If you want to reach out and say hello, I would of course love that. You can reach out to me on Twitter at Bodies Horror or over at Instagram at Bodies of Horror Podcast. And I'm also on Blue Sky, although I'm really horrible about posting there, and I've made it a goal to do better there. And my username over there is Bodies of Horror. And of course, you can go old school as well and shoot me an email at bodiesofhorror@gmail.com. Say hi. Let me know what you think of this movie. Were there elements of this film that you found really interesting related to disability? Or, you know, what did you just think about kind of how it explored an autistic coded character in comparison to maybe some of the others that we've talked about? I would love to have that discussion as well. So yeah, always reach out, say hello. Really horrible about putting this out there too, but I figured I would actually do this. You know, if you're not subscribed to the Anatomy of a Scream feed, hello, welcome. But please do subscribe to the feed. Lots of wonderful shows, and also write reviews, rate. It helps other people discover not just Bodies of Horror, but you know, the other shows that are on the feed. It's just really great that way. It's a wonderful way to support that those kind of shows that you really like listening to. You know, I don't have a Patreon, I don't have stuff like that. So you know, it's not just about me, it's also just about all the other amazing shows here on the feed. So but hey, yeah, rate, review, give Bodies of Horror a shout out if you like kind of the content here. I'm always trying to change things up a little bit, and I'm always looking for, you know, feedback on, you know, different topics, different films, you know, even kind of like different formats for different episodes. If, you know, I have tried to bring on guests as much as possible, because I'm sure that listening to me for 30 plus minutes may not always be the super funnest, but I do appreciate it. So yeah, if you want to support the show, that's a great way. Rate and review, make sure you're subscribed, and yeah, tell people about episodes. I always really love when I do get emails or messages from folks that say that they've listened to an episode and they really enjoyed it. It just makes my day, and it's really special. So thank you for listening, and until next time.
The Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad.